Funny sort of burglary, the desk guy said. There's an Amex card and money still in the wallet. We inventoried the contents. I didn't reply. Just went out through the doors, back to the Humvee. Summer waited for a gap in the traffic and then drove across all three lanes and bounced straight onto the soft grass median. She went down a slope and through a drainage ditch and straight up the other side. Paused and waited and turned left back onto the blacktop and headed south. That was the kind of thing a Humvee was good for.
"Try this," she said. "Last night, Vassal and Kuma leave Bird at 10 o'clock with a briefcase. They head north for Dulles or D.C. They extract the agenda and throw the case out the car window."
They were in the bar in the dining room, their old time at Bird.
"So one of their dinner companions passed it on. We should check who they ate with. Maybe one of the women on the Humvee list was there."
They were all alibied.
"Only superficially. New Year's Eve parties are pretty chaotic."
I looked out the window. Afternoon was fading fast. Evening was coming on. The world looked dark and cold. 60 miles, I said. The case was found 60 miles north of Bird. That's an hour. They would have grabbed the agenda and ditched the case faster than that. Summer said nothing. And they would have stopped at the rest area to do it. They would have put the case in a garbage can. That would have been safer. Throwing a briefcase out of a car window is pretty conspicuous.
"Maybe there really wasn't an agenda."
"It'd be the first time in military history."
"Then maybe it wasn't really important."
They ordered bag lunches at Irwin. 2 stars, 1 stars, and colonels were planning to work through their lunch hour. That might be the first time in military history, too. That was an important conference, Summer, believe me. She said nothing. "Do that U-turn thing again," I said, "across the median, then go back north a little. I want to look at the rest area." The rest area was the same as on most American interstates I'd seen. The northbound highway and the southbound highway eased apart to put a long, fat bulge into the median. The buildings were shared by both sets of travelers. Therefore, they had 2 fronts and no backs. They were built of brick and had dormant flower beds and leafless trees all around them. There were gas pumps. There were angled parking slots. Right then, the place seemed to be halfway between quiet and busy. It was the end of the holidays. Families were struggling home, ready for school, ready for work. The parking slots were maybe 1/3 filled with cars. Their distribution was interesting. People had grabbed the first parking spot they saw rather than chancing something farther on, even though that might have put them ultimately a little closer to the food and the bathrooms. Maybe it was human nature, some kind of insecurity. There was a small semicircular plaza at the facility's main entrance. I could see bright neon signs inside at the food stations. Outside, there were 6 trash cans, all fairly close to the doors. There were plenty of people around, looking in, looking out.
"Too public," Summer said. "This is going nowhere."
I nodded again. "I'd forget it in a heartbeat if it wasn't for Mrs. Kramer."
"Carbone is more important. We should prioritize."
That feels like we're giving up. We went north out of the rest area, and Summer did her off-roading thing across the median again and turned south. I got as comfortable as it was possible to get in a military vehicle, and settled in for the ride back. Darkness unspooled on my left. There was a vague sunset in the west to my right. The road looked damp. Summer didn't seem very worried about the possibility of ice. I did nothing for the first 20 minutes. Then I switched the dome light on and searched Kramer's briefcase, thoroughly. I didn't expect to find anything, and I wasn't proved wrong. His passport was a standard item, 7 years old. He looked a little better in the picture than he had dead in the motel, but not much. He had plenty of stamps in and out of Germany and Belgium, the future battlefield and NATO HQ, respectively. He hadn't been anywhere else. He was a true specialist. For at least 7 years, he had concentrated exclusively on the world's last great tank arena and its command structure. The plane tickets were exactly what Garber had said they should be. Frankfurt to Dulles and Washington National to Los Angeles, both round trip. They were all coach class and government rate, booked 3 days before the first departure date. The itinerary matched the details on the plane tickets exactly. There were seat assignments. It seemed like Kramer preferred the aisle. Maybe his age was affecting his bladder. There was a reservation for a single room in Fort Irwin's visiting officers' quarters, which he'd never reached. His wallet contained 37 American dollars and 67 German marks, all in mixed small bills. The Amex card was the basic green item, due to expire in a year and a half. He'd carried one since 1964, according to the Member Since rubric. I figured that was pretty early for an Army officer. Back then, most got by with cash and military scrip. Kramer must have been a sophisticated guy financially. There was a Virginia driver's license. He'd been using Green Valley as his permanent address, even though he avoided spending time there. There was a standard military ID card. There was a photograph of Mrs. Kramer behind a plastic window. It showed a much younger version of the woman I'd seen dead on her hallway floor. It was at least 20 years old. She'd been pretty back then. She had long auburn hair that showed up a little orange from the way the photograph had faded with age. There was nothing else in the wallet. No receipts, no restaurant checks, no Amex carbons, no phone numbers, no scraps of paper. I wasn't surprised. Generals are often neat, organized people. They need fighting talent, but they need bureaucratic talent, too. I guessed Kramer's office and desk and quarters would be the same as his wallet. They would contain everything he needed and nothing he didn't. The hardcover book was an academic monograph from a Midwestern university about the Battle of Kursk. Kursk happened in July of 1943. It was Nazi Germany's last grand offensive of World War II, and its first major defeat on an open battlefield. It turned into the greatest tank battle the world had ever seen, and ever will see, unless people like Kramer himself are eventually turned loose. I wasn't surprised by his choice of reading material. Some small part of him must have feared the closest he'd ever get to truly cataclysmic action was reading about the hundreds of tigers and panthers and T-34s whirling and roaring through the choking summer dust all those years ago. There was nothing else in the briefcase, just a few furred paper shreds trapped in the seams. It looked like Kramer was the sort of guy who emptied his case and turned it upside down and shook it every time he packed for a trip. I put everything back inside and buckled the little straps and laid the case on the floor by my feet. "Speak to the dining room guy," I said. "When we get back, find out who was at the table with Vassil and Coomer."
"Okay,"
Summer said. She drove on. We got back to Bird in time for dinner. We ate in the O Club bar with a bunch of fellow MPs. If Willard had spies among them, they would have seen nothing except a couple of tired people doing not very much of anything. But Summer slipped away between courses and came back with news in her eyes. I ate my dessert and drank my coffee slowly enough that nobody could think I had urgent business anywhere. Then I stood up and wandered out, waited in the cold on the sidewalk. Summer came out 5 minutes later. I smiled. It felt like we were conducting a clandestine affair.
"Only one woman ate with Vassil and Coomer," she said.
"Who?" I asked.
"Lieutenant Colonel Andrea Norton."
"The psyops person?"
"The very same."
"She was at a party on New Year's Eve." Summer made a face.
"You know what those parties are like. A bar in town, hundreds of people in and out all the time, noise, confusion, drinks, people disappearing two by two. She could have slipped away."
"Where was the bar?"
30 minutes from the motel."
"Then she would have been gone an hour, absolute minimum."
"That's possible."
"Was she in the bar at midnight, holding hands and singing Auld Lang Syne? Whoever was standing next to her should be able to say for sure."
"People say she was there, but she could have made it back by then anyway. The kid said the Humvee left at 11:25. She'd have been back with 5 minutes to spare. It could look natural, you know. Everybody comes out of the woodwork, ready for the ball to drop. Party kind of starts over."
I said nothing.
She would have taken the case to sanitize it. Maybe a phone number was in there, and a name, or a picture, or a diary. She didn't want scandal. But once she was through with it, she didn't need the rest of the stuff anymore. She'd have been happy to hand it back when asked.
How would Vaseline Coomer know who to ask?
Hard to hide a long-standing affair in this fishbowl.
Not logical, I said. If people knew about Kramer and Norton, why would someone go to the house in Virginia?
Okay, maybe they didn't know. Maybe it was just there on the list of possibilities. Maybe way down the list. Maybe it was something that people thought was over.
I nodded. What can we get from her?
We can get confirmation that Vaseline Coomer arranged to take possession of the briefcase last night. That would prove they were looking for her, which puts them in the frame for Mrs. Kramer.
They made no calls from the hotel, and they didn't have time to get down there themselves. So I don't see how we can put them in the frame. What else can we get?
We can be certain about what happened to the agenda. We can know that Vaseline Coomer got it back. Then at least the army can relax, because we'll know for sure it isn't going to wind up on some public trash pile for a journalist to find.
I nodded, said nothing.
And maybe Norton saw it,
Summer said.
Maybe she read it. Maybe she could tell us what all this fuss is about.
That's tempting.
It sure is.
Can we just walk in and ask her?
You're from the 110th. You can ask anyone anything.
I have to stay under Willard's radar.
She doesn't know he warned you off.
She does. He spoke to her after the Carbone thing.
I think we have to talk to her.
Difficult kind of a talk to have, I said. She's likely to get offended.
Only if we do it wrong.
What are the chances of doing it right?
We might be able to manipulate the situation. There'd be an embarrassment factor. She won't want it broadcast.
We can't push her to the point where she calls Willard.
You scared of him?
I'm scared of what he can do to us bureaucratically. Doesn't help anyone if we both get transferred to Alaska.
Your call.
I was quiet for a long moment. Thought back to Kramer's hardcover book. This was like July 13, 1943, the pivotal day of the Battle of Kursk. We were like Alexander Vasilevsky, the Soviet general. If we attack now, this minute, we had to keep on and on attacking until the enemy was run off his feet and the war was won. If we bogged down or paused for breath, even for a second, we'd be overrun again. Okay, I said. Let's do it. We found Andrea Norton in the O Club lounge, and I asked her if she would spare us a minute in her office. I could see she was puzzled as to why. I told her it was a confidential matter. She stayed puzzled. Willard had told her that Carbone was a closed case, and she couldn't see what else we would have to talk to her about. But she agreed. She told us she would meet us there in 30 minutes. Summer and I spent the 30 minutes in my office with her list of who was on post and who wasn't at Carbone's time of death. She had yards of computer paper neatly folded into a large concertina about an inch thick. There was a name, rank, and number printed on each line with pale dot matrix ink. Almost every name had a check mark next to it. What are the marks, I asked her. Here or not here?
Here,
she said. I nodded. I was afraid of that. I riffed through the concertina with my thumb. How many? I asked.
Nearly 1,200.
I nodded again. There was nothing intrinsically difficult about boiling down 1,200 names and finding one sole perpetrator. Police files everywhere are full of larger suspect pools. There had been cases in Korea where the entire U.S. military strength had been in the suspect pool. But cases like that require unlimited manpower, big staffs, and endless resources. And they require everybody's total cooperation. They can't be handled behind a CO's back in secret by two people acting alone. Impossible, I said.
Nothing's impossible,
Summer said. We have to go at it a different way.
How?
What did he take to the scene?
Nothing.
Wrong, I said. He took himself. Summer shrugged, dragged her fingers up the folded edges of her paper. The stack thickened and then thinned back down as the air sighed out from between the pages.
"Pick a name,"
she said. "He took a K-bar," I said.
1,200 names, 1,200 K-bars.
"He took a tire iron or a crowbar." She nodded. "And he took yogurt," I said. She said nothing. "Four things," I said. "Himself, a K-bar, a blunt instrument, and yogurt. Where'd the yogurt come from?"
"His refrigerator in his quarters,"
Summer said.
"Or one of the mess kitchens, or one of the mess buffets, or the commissary, or a supermarket, or a deli, or a grocery store somewhere off post."